Simon & Schuster Audio presents Everything's Eventual. Five Dark Tales by Stephen King. Read by Boyd Gaines, Judith Ivy, Justin Long, Oliver Platt, and J.O. Sanders. Everything's Eventual. Read by Justin Long.
One. I've got a good job now and no reason to feel glum. No more hanging out with the Gumby heads at the Super Saver policing up the cart corral and getting bothered by assholes like Skipper. Skipper's munching the old dirt sandwich these days, but one thing I have learned in my 19 years on this planet Earth is don't relax. There are Skippers everywhere. Ditto, no more pulling pizza patrol on rainy nights, driving my old Ford with a band muffler, freezing my ass off with the driver's side window down, and a little Italian flag sticking out on a wire, like somebody in Harkerville was going to salute. Pizza aroma. Quarter tips from people who don't even see you because most of their mind's still on the TV football game. Driving for Pizza Roma was the lowest point, I think. Since then, I've even had a ride in a private jet, so how could things be bad? This is what comes of leaving school without a diploma, Ma would say during my delivery Dan stint. And you've got this to look forward to for the rest of your life. Good old Ma. On and on until I actually thought about writing her one of those special letters. As I say, that was the low point. You know what Mr. Sharpton told me that night in his car? It's not just a job, Dink. It's a goddamn adventure. And he was right. Whatever he might have been wrong about, he was right about that. I suppose you're wondering about the salary of this famous job. Well, I gotta tell you, there's not much money in it. Might as well get that right up front. But a job isn't just about money or getting ahead. That's what Mr. Sharpton told me. Mr. Sharpton said that a real job is about the fringe benefits. He said that's where the power is. Mr. Sharpton. I only saw him that once, sitting behind the wheel of his big old Mercedes-Benz, but sometimes once is enough. Take that any way you want. Any old way at all. 2. I've got a house, okay? My very own house. That's fringe benefit number 1. I call Ma sometimes, ask her how her bad leg is, shoot the shit. But I've never invited her over here, although Harkerville's only 70 or so miles away, and I know she's practically busting a gut with curiosity. I don't even have to go see her unless I want to. Mostly I don't want to. If you knew my mother, you wouldn't want to either. Sit there in that living room with her while she talks about all her relatives and whines about her puffy leg. Also, I never noticed how much the house smelled of cat shit until I got out of it. I'm never going to have a pet. Pets bite the big one. Mostly I just stay here. It's only got 1 bedroom, but it's still an excellent house. Eventual, as Pug used to say. He was the one guy at the Super Saver I liked. When he wanted to say something was really good, Pug would never say it was awesome like most people do. He'd say it was eventual. How funny is that? The old Pugmeister. I wonder how he's doing. Okay, I suppose. But I can't call him and make sure. I can call my Ma and I have an emergency number if anything ever goes wrong, or if I think somebody's getting nosy about what's not their business, but I can't buzz any of my old friends, as if any of them besides Pug gave shit one about Dinky Earnshaw. Mr. Sharpton's rules. But never mind that. Let's go back to my house here in Columbia City. How many 19-year-old high school dropouts do you know who have their own houses? plus a new car. Only a Honda, true, but the first three numbers on the odometer are still zeros, and that's the important part. It has a CD tape player, and I don't slide in behind the wheel wondering if the goddamn thing will start, like I always did with the Ford, which Skipper used to make fun of. The asshole mobile, he'd call it. Why are there so many Skippers in the world? That's what I really wonder about. I do get some money, by the way, more than enough to meet my needs. Check this out. I watch as the world turns every day while I'm eating my lunch, and on Thursdays, about halfway through the show, I hear the clack of the mail slot. I don't do anything then. I'm not supposed to. Like Mr. Sharpton said, them's the rules, Dink. I just watch the rest of my show. The exciting stuff on the soaps always happens around the weekends. Murders on Fridays, fucking on Mondays. But I watch right to the end every day just the same. I'm especially careful to stay in the living room until the end on Thursdays. On Thursdays, I don't even go out to the kitchen for another glass of milk. When World is over, I turn off the TV for a while. Oprah Winfrey comes on next. I hate her show. All that sitting around talking shit is for the Maz of the world. And go out to the front hall. Lying on the floor under the mail slot, there's always a plain white envelope sealed. Nothing written on the front. Inside there'll be either 14 $5 bills or 7 $10 bills. That's my money for the week. Here's what I do with it. I go to the movies twice, always in the afternoon, when it's just $4.50. That's $9. On Saturday, I fill up my Honda with gas, and that's usually about $7. I don't drive much. I'm not invested in it, as Pug would say. So now we're up to $16. I'll eat out maybe four times at Mickey D's, either at breakfast, Egg McMuffin, coffee, two hash browns, or at dinner, quarter pounder with cheese, never mind that mixed special shit. What dimbulb thought those up? Once a week, I put on chinos and a button-up shirt, and I see how the other half lives. Have a fancy meal at a place like Adam's Ribs or the Chuck Wagon. All of that goes me about $25, and now we're up to $41. Then I might go buy News Plus and buy a stroke book or two. Nothing really kinky, just your usual, like, Variations or Penthouse. I have tried writing these mags down on Dinky's Dayboard, but with no success. I can buy them myself, and they don't disappear on cleaning day or anything. But they don't show up, if you see what I'm getting at, like most other stuff does. I guess Mr. Sharpton's cleaners don't like to buy dirty stuff. Pun. Also, I can't get to any of the sex stuff on the internet. I have tried, but it's blacked out somehow. Usually things like that are easy to deal with. You go under or around the roadblocks if you can't hack straight through, but this is different. Not to belabor the point, but I can't dial 900 numbers on the phone either. The auto-dialer works, of course, and if I want to call somebody just at random, anywhere in the world, and shoot the shit with them for a while, that's okay. That works. But the 900 numbers don't. You just get a busy. Probably just as well. In my experience, thinking about sex is like scratching poison ivy. You only spread it around. Besides, sex is no big deal, at least for me. It's there, but it isn't eventual. Still, considering what I'm doing, that little prudy streak is sort of weird. Almost funny. Except I seem to have lost my sense of humor on the subject. A few others as well. Oh well, back to the budget. If I get a Variations, that's $4 and we're up to $45. Some of the money that's left I might use to buy a CD, although I don't have to, or a candy bar or two. I know I shouldn't because my complexion still blows dead rats, although I'm almost not a teenager anymore. I think of calling out for a pizza or for Chinese sometimes, but it's against TransCorp's rules. Also, I would feel weird doing it, like a member of the oppressing class. I have delivered pizza, remember. I know what a sucky job it is. Still, if I could order in, the pizza guy wouldn't leave this house with a quarter tip. I'd lay $5 on him, watch his eyes light up. But you're starting to see what I mean about not needing a lot of cash, aren't you? When Thursday morning rolls around again, I usually have at least $8 left, and sometimes it's more like 20. What I do with the coins is drop them down the storm drain in front of my house. I am aware that this would freak the neighbors out if they saw me doing it. I'm a high school dropout, but I didn't leave because I was stupid, thank you very much. So I take out the blue plastic recycling basket with the newspapers in it and sometimes with a penthouse or variations buried halfway down the stack. I don't keep that shit around for long. Who would? And while I'm putting it down on the curb, I open the hand with the change in it, and through the grate in the gutter it goes. Tinkle, 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 splash, like a magician's trick. Now you see it, now you don't. Someday that drain will get clogged up, they'll send a guy down there, and he'll think he won the fucking lottery. Unless there's a flood or something that pushes all the change down to the waste treatment plant or wherever it goes. By then I'll be gone. I'm not going to spend my life in Columbia City, I can tell you that. I'm leaving, and soon, one way or the other. The currency is easier. I just poke it down the garbage disposal in the kitchen. Another magic trick. Presto, change-o, money into lettuce. You probably think that's very weird, running money through the sink pig. I did too, at first. But you get used to just about anything after you do it for a while. And besides, there's always another 70 falling through the letter slot. The rule is simple. No squirreling it away. End the week broke. Besides, it's not millions we're talking about, only 8 or 10 bucks a week. Chump change, really. 3. Dinky's Day Board. That's another fringe benefit. I write down whatever I want during the week, and I get everything I ask for, except sex mags, as I told you. Maybe I'll get bored with that eventually, but right now it's like having Santa Claus all year round. Mostly what I write down is groceries, like anyone does on their kitchen chalkboard, but by no means is groceries all. I might, for instance, write down new Bruce Willis video, or new Weezer CD, or something like that. A funny thing about that Weezer CD, since we're on the subject, I happened to go into Tunes Express one Friday after my movie was over. I always go to the show on Friday afternoons, even if there's nothing I really want to see, because that's when the cleaners come. Just killing time inside because it was rainy and that squashed going to the park. And while I was looking at the new releases, this kid asks a clerk about the new Weezer CD. The clerk tells him it won't be in for another 10 days or so, but I'd had it since the Friday before. Fringe benefits, like I say. If I write down sports shirt on the day board, there it is when I get back to the house on Friday night, always in one of the nice earth tone colors I like. If I write down new jeans or chinos, I get those. All stuff from the Gap, which is where I'd go myself if I had to do stuff like that. If I want a certain kind of aftershave lotion or cologne, I write the name on Dinky's day board and it's on the bathroom counter when I get home. I don't date, but I'm a fool for cologne. Go figure. Here's something you'll laugh at, I bet. Once I wrote down Rembrandt painting on the day board, then I spent the afternoon at the movies and walking in the park, watching people making out and dogs catching frisbees, thinking how eventual it would be if the cleaners actually brought me my own fucking Rembrandt. Think of it. A genuine old master on the wall of a house in the Sunset Knoll section of Columbia City. How eventual would that be? And it happened, in a manner of speaking. My Rembrandt was hung on the living room wall when I got home, over the sofa where the velvet clowns used to be. My heart was beating about 200 a minute as I walked across the room toward it. When I got closer, I saw it was just a copy, you know, a reproduction. I was disappointed, but not very. I mean, it was a Rembrandt, just not an original Rembrandt. Another time I wrote autographed photo of Nicole Kidman on the day board. I think she's the best-looking actress alive. She just gets me on so much. And when I got home that day, there was a publicity still of her on the fridge, held there by a couple of those little vegetable magnets. She was on her Moulin Rouge swing. And that time it was the real deal. I know because of the way it was signed. To Dinky Earnshaw, with love and kisses from Nicole. Oh, baby. Oh, honey. Tell you something, my friend. If I worked hard and really wanted it, there might be a real Rembrandt on my wall someday. Sure. In a job like this, there is nowhere to go but up. In a way, that's the scary part. 4. I never have to make grocery lists. The cleaners know what I like. Stouffer's frozen dinners, especially that boil-in-the-bag stuff they call creamed chip beef, and Ma had always called shit on a shingle. Frozen strawberries, whole milk, preformed hamburger patties that you just have to slap in a hot frying pan. I hate playing with raw meat. Dole puddings, the ones that come in plastic cups. Bad for my complexion, but I love them. Ordinary food like that. If I want something special, I write it down on Dinky's dayboard. Once I asked for a homemade apple pie, specifically not from the supermarket. And when I came back that night around the time it was getting dark, my pie was in the fridge with the rest of the week's groceries. Only it wasn't wrapped up, it was just sitting there on a blue plate. That's how I knew it was homemade. I was a little hesitant about eating it at first, not knowing where it came from and all. And then I decided I was being stupid. A person doesn't really know where supermarket food comes from. Not really. I mean, we assume it's okay because it's wrapped up or in a can or double sealed for your protection. But anyone could have been handling it with dirty fingers before it was double sealed or sneezing great big whoops of booger breath on it or even wiping their asses with it. I don't mean to gross you out, but it's true, isn't it? The world is full of strangers, and a lot of them are up to no good. I have had personal experience of this, believe me. Anyway, I tried the pie, and it was delicious. I ate half of it Friday night and the rest on Saturday morning while I was running the numbers in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Most of Saturday night I spent on the toilet, shitting my guts out from all those apples, I guess, but I didn't care. The pie was worth it. Like my mother used to make, is what people say. But it can't be my mother they say it about. My ma couldn't fry Spam. 5. I never have to write down underwear on the dayboard. Every 5 weeks or so, the old drawers disappear, and there are brand new Hanes jockey shorts in my bureau. 4 3-packs still in their plastic bags. Double sealed for my protection. Toilet paper, laundry soap, dishwasher soap. I never have to write any of that shit down. It just appears. Very eventual, don't you think? 6. I have never seen the cleaners any more than I have ever seen the guy, or maybe it's a gal, who delivers my $70 every Thursday during As the World Turns. I never want to see them either. I don't need to, for one thing. For another, yes, okay, I'm afraid of them, just like I was afraid of Mr. Sharpton and his big gray Mercedes on the night I went out to meet him, so sue me. I don't eat lunch in my house on Fridays. I watch As the World Turns, then jump in my car and drive into town. I get a burger at Mickey D's, then go to a movie, then to the park if the weather is good. I like the park. It's a good place to think, and these days I've got an awful lot to think about. If the weather is bad, I go to the mall. Now that the days are beginning to shorten, I'm thinking about taking up bowling again. It'd be something to do on Friday afternoons, at least. I used to go now and then with Pug. I sort of miss Pug. I wish I could call him, just shoot this shit, tell him some of the stuff that's been going on, like about that guy Neff, for instance. Oh well, spit in the ocean and see if it comes back. While I'm away, the cleaners are doing my house from wall to wall and top to bottom. Wash the dishes, although I'm pretty good about that myself. Wash the floors, wash the dirty clothes, change the sheets, put out fresh towels, restock the fridge, get any of the incidentals that are written on the dayboard. It's like living in a hotel with the world's most efficient, not to mention eventual, maid service. The one place they don't mess around with much is the study off the dining room. I keep that room fairly dark, the shades always pulled, and they have never raised them to let in so much as a crack of daylight like they do in the rest of the house. It never smells of lemon pledge in there either, although every other room just about reeks of it on Friday nights. Sometimes it's so bad I have these sneezing fits. It's not an allergy, more like nasal protest demonstration. Someone vacuums the floor in there and they empty the waste paper basket. But no one has ever moved any of the papers that I keep on the desk, no matter how cluttered up and junky-looking they are. Once I put a little piece of tape over where the drawer above the knee hole opens, but it was still there, unbroken, when I got back home that night. I don't keep anything top secret in that drawer, you understand. I just wanted to know. Also, if the computer and modem are on when I leave, they're still on when I come back. The VDT showing one of the screensaver programs, usually the one of the people doing stuff behind their blinds in this high-rise building, because that's my favorite. If my stuff was off when I left, it's off when I come back. They don't mess around in Dinky's study. Maybe the cleaners are a little afraid of me, too. 7. I got the call that changed my life just when I thought the combination of Ma and delivering for Pizza Roma was going to drive me crazy. I know how melodramatic that sounds, but in this case it's true. The call came on my night off. Ma was out with her girlfriends playing bingo at the reservation, all of them smoking up a storm and no doubt laughing every time the caller pulled B12 out of the hopper and said, "All right, ladies, it's time to take your vitamins." Me, I was watching a Clint Eastwood movie on TNT and wishing I was anywhere else on planet Earth, Saskatchewan even. The phone rings, and I think, "Oh, good, it's Pug. Gotta be." And so when I pick it up, I say in my smoothest voice, "You have reached the Church of Any Eventuality, Harkerville Branch, Reverend Dink speaking." "Hello, Mr. Earnshaw," a voice says back. It was one I never heard before, but it didn't seem the least put out or puzzled by my bullshit. I was mortified enough for both of us, though. Have you ever noticed that when you do something like that on the phone, try to be cool right from the pickup, it's never the person you expected on the other end? Once I heard about this girl who picked up the phone and said, "Hi, it's Helen. I want you to fuck me raw," because she was sure it was her boyfriend, only it turned out to be her father. That story is probably made up, like the one about the alligators in the New York sewers, or the letters in Penthouse, but you get the point. "Oh, I'm sorry," I say, too flustered to wonder how the owner of this strange voice knows that Reverend Dink is also Mr. Earnshaw, actual name Richard Ellery Earnshaw. "I thought you were someone else." "I am someone else," the voice says. And although I didn't laugh then, I did later on. Mr. Sharpton was someone else, all right. Seriously, eventually someone else. "Can I help you?" I asked. "If you wanted my mother, I'll have to take a message because she's out playing bingo. I know. In any case, I want you, Mr. Earnshaw. I want to offer you a job." For a moment, I was too surprised to say anything. Then it hit me. Some sort of phone scam. "I got a job," I go. "Sorry." "Delivering pizza?" he says, sounding amused. "Well, I suppose if you call that a job." "Who are you, mister?" I ask. "My name is Sharpton, and now let me cut through the bullshit, as you might say, Mr. Earnshaw. Dink? May I call you Dink?" "Sure," I said. "Can I call you Sharpie?" "Call me whatever you want. Just listen." I'm listening. I was, too. Why not? The movie on the tube was Coogan's Bluff, not one of Clint's better efforts. "I want to make you the best job offer you've ever had, and the best one you probably ever will have. It's not just a job, Dink. It's an adventure." "Gee, where have I heard that before?" I had a bowl of popcorn in my lap, and I tossed a handful into my mouth. This was turning into fun, sort of. "Others promise, I deliver. But this is a discussion we must have face to face. Will you meet me?" "Are you a queer?" I asked. "No." There was a touch of amusement in his voice, just enough so that it was hard to disbelieve. And I was already in the hole, so to speak, from the smart-ass way I'd answered the phone. "My sexual orientation doesn't come into this." "Why are you yanking my chain, then? I don't know anybody who'd call me at 9:30 in the fucking night and offer me a job." "Do me a favor. Put the phone down and go look in your front hall." Crazier and crazier. But what did I have to lose? I did what he said and found an envelope lying there. Someone had poked it through the mail slot while I was watching Clint Eastwood chase Don Stroud through Central Park. The first envelope of many, although of course I didn't know that then. I tore it open and 7 $10 bills fell out into my hand, also a note. This can be the beginning of a great career. I went back into the living room, still looking at the money. Know how weirded out I was? I almost sat on my bowl of popcorn. I saw it at the last second, set it aside, and plopped back on the couch. I picked up the phone, really sort of expecting Sharpton to be gone. But when I said hello, he answered. What's this all about? I asked him. What's this $70 for? I'm keeping it, but not because I think I owe you anything. I didn't fucking ask for anything. The money is absolutely yours, Sharpton says, with not a string in the world attached. But I'll let you in on a secret, Dink. A job isn't just about money. A real job is about the fringe benefits. That's where the power is.
If you say so.
I absolutely do. And all I ask is that you meet me and hear a little more. I'll make you an offer that will change your life if you take it. That will open the door to a new life, in fact. Once I've made that offer, you can ask all the questions you like. Although, I must be honest and say you probably won't get all the answers you'd like.
And if I just decide to walk away?
I'll shake your hand, clap you on the back, and wish you good luck.
When did you want to meet?
Part of me, most of me, still thought all this was a joke. But there was a minority opinion forming by then. There was the money, for one thing. 2 weeks' worth of tips driving for Pizza Roma, and that's if business was good. But mostly it was the way Sharpton talked. He sounded like he'd been to school. And I don't mean Sheep's Rectum State College over in Van Drusen either. And really, what harm could there be? Since Skipper's accident, there was no one on planet Earth who wanted to take after me in a way that was dangerous or painful. Well, Ma, I suppose, but her only weapon was her mouth, and she wasn't into elaborate practical jokes. Also, I couldn't see her parting with $70, not when there was still a bingo game in the vicinity. Tonight, he said. Right now, in fact.
All right, why not? Come on over. I guess if you can drop an envelope full of tens through the mail slot, you don't need me to give you the address.
Not at your house. I'll meet you in the Super Saver parking lot. My stomach dropped like an elevator with the cables cut, and the conversation stopped being the least bit funny. Maybe this was some kind of setup, something with cops in it even. I told myself no one could know about Skipper, least of all the cops, but Jesus. There was the letter. Skipper could have left the letter lying around anywhere. Nothing in it anyone could make out, except for his sister's name, but there are millions of Debbies in the world. No more than anyone could have made out the stuff I wrote on the sidewalk outside Mrs. Bukowski's yard. Or so I would have said before the goddamn phone rang. But who could be absolutely sure? And you know what they say about a guilty conscience. I didn't exactly feel guilty about Skipper. Not then, but still. The Super Saver's kind of a weird place for a job interview, don't you think? Especially when it's been closed since 8 o'clock.
That's what makes it good, Dink. Privacy in a public place. I'll park right by the cart corral. You'll know the car. It's a big gray Mercedes.
I'll know it because it'll be the only one there, I said. But he was already gone. I hung up and put the money in my pocket, almost without realizing I was doing it. I was sweating lightly all over my body. The voice on the phone wanted to meet me by the cart corral where Skipper had so often teased me, where he had once mashed my fingers between a couple of shopping carts, laughing when I screamed. That hurts the worst, getting your fingers mashed. 2 of the nails had turned black and fallen off. That was when I'd made up my mind to try the letter, and the results had been unbelievable. Still, if Skipper Brannigan had a ghost, the cart corral was likely where it would hang out, looking for fresh victims to torture. The voice on the phone couldn't have picked that place by accident. I tried to tell myself that was bullshit, that coincidences happen all the time, but I just didn't believe it. Mr. Sharpton knew about Skipper. Somehow, he knew.
I was afraid to meet him, but I didn't see what choice I had. If nothing else, I ought to find out how much he knew, and who he might tell. I got up, put on my coat. It was early spring then, and cold at night. It seems to me that it's always cold at night in western Pennsylvania. Started out the door, then went back and left a note for Ma. Went out to see a couple of guys, I wrote. We'll be back by midnight. I intended to be back well before midnight, but that note seemed like a good idea. I wouldn't let myself think too closely about why it seemed like a good idea. Not then, but I can own up to it now. If something happened to me, something bad, I wanted to make sure Ma would call the police. 8. There are two kinds of scared. At least that's my theory. There's TV scared, and there's real scared. I think we go through most of our lives only getting TV scared. Like when we're waiting for our blood test to come back from the doctor, or when we're walking home from the library in the dark and thinking about bad guys in the bushes. We don't get real scared about shit like that because we know in our heart of hearts that the blood test will come back clean and there won't be any bad guys in the bushes. Why? Because stuff like that only happens to the people on TV. When I saw that big gray Mercedes, the only car in about an acre of empty parking lot, I got real scared for the first time since the thing in the box room with Skipper Brannigan. That time was the closest we ever came to really getting into it. Mr. Sharpton's ride was sitting under the light of the lot's yellow mercury vapor lamps, a big old Krautmobile, at least a 450 and probably a 500, the kind of car that costs 120 grand these days. Sitting there next to the cart corral, now almost empty for the night, all the carts except for one poor old three-wheeled cripple safely locked up inside, with its parking lights on and white exhaust drifting up into the air, engine rumbling like a sleepy cat. I drove toward it, my heart pumping slow but hard, and it tastes like pennies in my throat. I wanted to just mat the accelerator of my Ford, which in those days always smelled like a pepperoni pizza, and get the hell out of there. But I couldn't get rid of the idea that the guy knew about Skipper. I could tell myself there was nothing to know, that Charles Skipper Brannigan had either had an accident or committed suicide. The cops weren't sure which. They couldn't have known him very well. If they had, they would have thrown the idea of suicide right out the window. Guys like Skipper don't off themselves. Not at the age of 23, they don't. But that didn't stop the voice from yammering away that I was in trouble. Someone had figured it out. Someone had gotten hold of the letter and figured it out. That voice didn't have logic on its side, but it didn't need to. It had good lungs and just out-screamed logic. I parked beside the idling Mercedes and rolled my window down. At the same time, the driver's side window of the Mercedes rolled down. We looked at each other, me and Mr. Sharpton, like a couple of old friends meeting at the Hi-Hat drive-in. I don't remember much about him now. That's weird, considering all the time I've spent thinking about him since, but it's the truth. Only that he was thin, and that he was wearing a suit. A good one, I think, although judging stuff like that's not my strong point. Still, the suit eased me a little. I guess that unconsciously I had this idea that a suit means business, and jeans and a t-shirt means fuckery. "Hello, Dink," he says. "I'm Mr. Sharpton. Come on in here and sit down." "Why don't we just stay the way we are?" I asked. "We can talk to each other through these windows. People do it all the time." He only looked at me and said nothing. After a few seconds of that, I turned off the Ford and got out. I don't know exactly why, but I did. I was more scared than ever. I can tell you that. Real scared. Real as real as real. Maybe that was why he could get me to do what he wanted. I stood between Mr. Sharpton's car and mine for a minute, looking at the cart corral and thinking about Skipper. He was tall, with this wavy blonde hair he combed straight back from his forehead. He had pimples and these red lips like a girl wearing lipstick. "Hey, Dinky, let's see your dinky," he'd say. Or, "Hey, Dinky, you want to suck my dinky?" You know, witty shit like that. Sometimes when we were rounding up the carts, he'd chase me with one, nipping at my heels with it and going, "Rum, rum, rum," like a fucking race car. A couple of times he knocked me over. At dinner break, if I had my food on my lap, he'd bump into me good and hard, see if he could knock something onto the floor. You know the kind of stuff I'm talking about, I'm sure. It was like he'd never gotten over those ideas of what's funny to bored kids sitting in the back row of study hall. I had a ponytail at work. You had to wear your hair in a ponytail if you had it long, supermarket rules. And sometimes Skipper would come up behind me, grab the rubber band I used, and yank it out. Sometimes it would snarl in my ear and pull it. Sometimes it would break and snap against my neck. It got so I'd stick two or three extra rubber bands in my pants pocket before I left for work. I'd try not to think about why I was doing it, what I was putting up with. If I did, I'd probably start hating myself. Once I turned around on my heels when he did that, and he must have seen something on my face because his teasing smile went away and another one came up where it had been. The teasing smile didn't show his teeth, but the new one did. Out in the box room this was, where the north wall is always cold because it backs up against the meat locker. He raised his hands and made them into fists. The other guys sat around with their lunches looking at us. I knew none of them would help, not even Pug, who stands about 5'4" anyway and weighs about 110 pounds. Skipper would have eaten him like candy, and Pug knew it. "Come on, ass face," Skipper said, smiling that smile. The broken rubber band he'd stripped out of my hair was dangling between two of his knuckles, hanging down like a little red lizard's tongue. "Come on, you want to fight me? Come on, sure, I'll fight you." What I wanted was to ask why it had to be me he settled on. Why it was me who somehow rubbed his fur wrong. Why it had to be any guy. But he wouldn't have had an answer. Guys like Skipper never do. They just want to knock your teeth out. So instead, I just sat back down and picked up my sandwich again. If I tried to fight Skipper, he'd likely put me in the hospital. I started to eat, although I wasn't hungry anymore. He looked at me a second or two longer, and I thought he might go after me anyway, but then he unrolled his fists. The broken rubber band dropped onto the floor beside a smashed lettuce crate. "You waste," Skipper said. "You fucking long-hair hippie waste." Then he walked away. It was only a few days later that he mashed my fingers between two of the carts in the corral. And a few days after that, Skipper was lying on satin in the Methodist church with the organ playing. He brought it on himself, though. At least that's what I thought then. "Our little trip down memory lane?" Mr. Sharpton asked. And that jerked me back to the present. I was standing between his cart and mine, standing by the cart corral where Skipper would never mash anyone else's fingers. "I don't know what you're talking about."
"And it doesn't matter. Hop in here, Dink, and let's have a little talk."
I opened the door of the Mercedes and got in. Man, that smell. It's leather, but not just leather. You know how in Monopoly there's a get-out-of-jail-free card? When you're rich enough to afford a car that smells like Mr. Sharpton's gray Mercedes, you must have a get-out-of-everything-free card. I took a deep breath, held it, then let it out and said, "This is eventual." Mr. Sharpton laughed, his clean-shaven cheeks gleaming in the dashboard lights. He didn't ask what I meant. He knew.
"Everything's eventual, Dink," he said. "Or can be, for the right person."
"Well, you think so?"
"No, so."
Not a shred of doubt in his voice. "I like your tie," I said. I said it just to be saying something, but it was true, too. The tie wasn't what I'd call eventual, but it was good. You know those ties that are printed all over with skulls or dinosaurs or little golf clubs, stuff like that. Mr. Sharpton's was printed all over with swords, a firm hand holding each one up. He laughed and ran a hand down it, kind of stroking it.
"It's my lucky tie," he said. "When I put it on, I feel like King Arthur."
The smile died off his face little by little, and I realized he wasn't joking.
"King Arthur, out gathering the best men there ever were. Knights to sit with him at the round table and remake the world."
That gave me a chill, but I tried not to show it. "What do you want with me, Art? Help you hunt for the Holy Grail or whatever they call it?"
A tie doesn't make a man a king, he said. I know that, in case you were wondering.
I shifted, feeling a little uncomfortable. Hey, I wasn't trying to put you down.
It doesn't matter, Dink, really. The answer to your question is I'm 2 parts headhunter, 2 parts talent scout, and 4 parts walking, talking destiny. Cigarette?
I don't smoke.
That's good. You'll live longer. Cigarettes are killers. Why else would people call them coffin nails?
You got me, I said.
I hope so, Mr. Sharpton said, lighting up. I most sincerely hope so. Your top shelf goods, Dink. I doubt if you believe that, but it's true.
What's this offer you were talking about?
Tell me what happened to Skipper Brannigan.
Kabam! My worst fear come true. He couldn't know, nobody could, but somehow he did. I only sat there feeling numb, my head pounding, my tongue stuck to the roof of my mouth like it was glued there.
Come on, tell me.
His voice seemed to be coming in from far away, like on a shortwave radio late at night. I got my tongue back where it belonged. It took an effort, but I managed. I didn't do anything. My own voice seemed to be coming through on that same shitty shortwave band. Skipper had an accident, that's all. He was driving home, and he went off the road. His car rolled over and went into Lockerbie Stream. They found water in his lungs, so I guess he drowned. At least technically, but it was in the paper that he probably would have died anyway. Most of his head got torn off in the rollover, or that's what people say. And some people say it wasn't an accident, that he killed himself, but I don't buy that. Skipper was, he was getting too much fun out of life to kill himself.
Yes, you were part of his fun, weren't you?
I didn't say anything, but my lips were trembling and there were tears in my eyes. Mr. Sharpton reached over and put his hand on my arm. It was the kind of thing you'd expect to get from an old guy like him, sitting with him in his big German car in a deserted parking lot. But I knew when he touched me that it wasn't like that. He wasn't hitting on me. It was good to be touched the way he touched me. Until then, I didn't know how sad I was. Sometimes you don't, because it's just, I don't know, all around. I put my head down. I didn't start bawling or anything, but the tears went running down my cheeks. The swords on his tie doubled, then tripled. 3 for 1, such a deal.
If you're worried that I'm a cop, you can quit. And I gave you money. That screws up any sort of prosecution that might come out of this. But even if that wasn't the case, no one would believe what really happened to young Mr. Brannigan anyway. Not even if you confessed on nationwide TV, would they?
No, I whispered. Then louder. I put up with a lot. Finally, I couldn't put up with any more. He made me... He brought it on himself.
Tell me what happened.
Mr. Sharpton said. I wrote him a letter, I said. A special letter.
Yes, very special indeed. And what did you put in it so it could only work on him?
I knew what he meant, but there was more to it than that. When you personalized the letters, you increased their power. You made them lethal, not just dangerous. His sister's name, I said. I think that was when I gave up completely. His sister, Debbie. 9. I've always had something, some kind of deal, and I sort of knew it, but not how to use it or what its name was or what it meant. And I sort of knew I had to keep quiet about it because other people didn't have it. I thought they might put me in the circus if they found out, or in jail. I remember once, vaguely, I might have been 3 or 4. It's one of my first memories. Standing by this dirty window and looking out at the yard. There was a wood chopping block and a mailbox with a red flag, so it must have been while we were at Aunt Mabel's out in the country. That was where we lived after my father ran off. Ma got a job in the Harkerville Fancy Bakery, and we moved back to town later on when I was 5 or so. We were living in town when I started school. I know that. Because of Mrs. Bukowski's dog having to walk past that fucking canine cannibal 5 days a week. I'll never forget that dog. He was a boxer with a white ear. Talk about memory lane. Anyway, I was looking out, and there were these flies buzzing around at the top of the window. You know how they do? I didn't like the sound, but I couldn't reach high enough, even with a rolled-up magazine, to swap them or make them go away. So instead of that, I made these two triangles on the window pane, drawing in the dirt with the tip of my finger, and I made this other shape, a special circle shape, to hold the triangles together. And as soon as I did that, as soon as I closed the circle, the flies, there were four or five of them, dropped dead on the windowsill. Big as jelly beans they were, the black jelly beans that taste like licorice. I picked one up and looked at it, but it wasn't very interesting, so I dropped it on the floor and went on looking out the window. Stuff like that would happen from time to time, but never on purpose, never because I made it happen. The first time I remember doing something absolutely on purpose, before Skipper, I mean, was when I used my whatever it was on Mrs. Bukowski's dog. Mrs. Bukowski lived on the corner of our street when we rented on Dugway Avenue. Her dog was mean and dangerous. Every kid on the west side was afraid of that white-eared fuck. She kept it tied to her side yard. Hell, staked out in her side yard is more like it. And it barked at everyone who went by. Not harmless yapping like some dogs do, but the kind that says, "If I could get you in here with me or get out there with you, I'd tear your balls off, Brewster." Once the dog did get loose and it bit the paperboy, anyone else's dog probably would have sniffed gas for that, but Mrs. Bukowski's son was the police chief, and he fixed it up somehow. I hated that dog the way I hated Skipper. In a way, I suppose it was Skipper. I had to go by Mrs. Bukowski's on my way to school unless I wanted to detour all the way around the block and get called a sissy boy, and I was terrified of the way that mutt would run to the end of its rope, barking so hard that foam would fly off its teeth and muzzle. Sometimes it hit the end of the rope so hard it'd go right off its feet. Boing! Which might have looked funny to some people, but never looked funny to me. I was just scared the rope, not a chain, but a plain old piece of rope, would break one day and the dog would jump over the low picket fence between Mrs. Bukowski's yard and Dugway Avenue, and it would rip my throat out. Then one day, I woke up with an idea. I mean, it was right there. I woke up with it the way some days I'd wake up with a great big throbbing boner. It was a Saturday, bright and early, and I didn't have to go anywhere near Mrs. Bukowski's if I didn't want to, but that day I did want to. I got out of bed and threw on my clothes just as fast as I could. I did everything fast because I didn't want to lose that idea. I would, too. I'd lose it the way you eventually lose the dreams you wake up with, or the boners you wake up with if you want to be crude. But right then, I had the whole thing in my mind just as clear as a bell. Words with triangles around them and curlicues over them. Special circles to hold the whole shebang together. Two or three of those, overlapping for extra strength. I just about flew through the living room. Ma was still sleeping. I could hear her snoring, and her pink bakery uniform was hung over the shower rod in the bathroom, and I went into the kitchen. Ma had a little blackboard by the phone for numbers and reminders to herself. Ma's dayboard instead of Dinky's dayboard, I guess you'd say. And I stopped just long enough to gleep the piece of pink chalk hanging on a string beside it. I put it in my pocket and went out the door. I remember what a beautiful morning that was. Cool, but not cold. The sky was so blue it looked like someone had run it through the Happy Wheels car wash. No one moving around much yet, most folks sleeping in a little, like everyone likes to do on Saturdays if they can. Mrs. Bukowski's dog wasn't sleeping in. Fuck no. That dog was a firm believer in Rudy Tooty Do Your Duty. It saw me coming through the picket fence and went charging to the end of its rope as hard as ever, maybe even harder, as if some part of its dim little doggy brain knew it was Saturday, and I had no business being there. It hit the end of the rope, boing, and went right over backwards. It was up again in a second, though, standing at the end of its rope and barking in its chalky, "I'm strangling, but I don't care" way. I suppose Mrs. Bukowski was used to that sound, maybe even liked it, but I've wondered since how the neighbors stood it. I paid no attention that day. I was too excited to be scared. I fished the chalk out of my pocket and dropped down on one knee. For one second, I thought the whole works had gone out of my head, and that was bad. I felt despair and sadness trying to fill me up, and I thought, "No, don't let it. Don't let it, Dinky. Fight it. Write anything, even if it's only fuck Mrs. Bukowski's dog." But I didn't write that. I drew this shape. I think it was a Senkophyte instead. Some weird shape, but the right shape, because it unlocked everything else. My head flooded with stuff. It was wonderful, but at the same time, it was really scary because there was so fucking much of it. For the next 5 minutes or so, I knelt there on the sidewalk, sweating like a pig and writing like a mad fiend. I wrote words I'd never heard and drew shapes I'd never seen, shapes nobody had ever seen. Not just Senkophytes, but Japs and Fowders and Mercs. I wrote and drew until I was pink dust halfway to my right elbow, and Ma's piece of chalk was nothing but a little pebble between my thumb and finger. Mrs. Bukowski's dog didn't die like the flies. It barked at me the whole time, and it probably drew back and ran out the length of its rope leash another time or two, but I didn't notice. I was in this total frenzy. I could never describe it to you in a million years, but I bet it's how great musicians like Mozart and Eric Clapton feel when they're writing their music, or how painters feel when they're getting their best work on canvas. If someone had come along, I would have ignored him. Shit, if Mrs. Bukowski's dog had finally broken its rope, jumped the fence, and clamped down on my ass, I probably would have ignored that. It was eventual, man. It was so fucking eventual, I can't even tell you. No one did come, although a few cars went by, and maybe the people in them wondered what that kid was doing, what he was drawing on the sidewalk, and Mrs. Bukowski's dog went on barking. At the end, I realized I had to make it stronger, and the way to do that was to make it just for the dog. I didn't know its name, so I printed Boxer with the last of the chalk, drew a circle around it, then made an arrow at the bottom of the circle pointing to the rest. I felt dizzy and my head was throbbing, the way it does when you've just finished taking a super hard test, or if you spend too long watching TV. I felt like I was going to be sick, but I still also felt totally eventual. I looked at the dog. It was still just as lively as ever, barking and kind of prancing on its back legs when it ran out of slack, but that didn't bother me. I went back home feeling easy in my mind. I knew Mrs. Bukowski's dog was toast. The same way I bet that a good painter knows when he's painted a good picture, or a good writer knows when he's written a good story. When it's right, I think you just know. It sits there in your head and hums. 3 days later, the dog was eating the old dirt sandwich. I got the story from the best possible source when it comes to mean asshole dogs, the neighborhood mailman. Mr. Schermerhorn, his name was. Mr. Schermerhorn said Mrs. Bukowski's boxer, for some reason, started running around the tree he was tied to, and when he got to the end of his rope, end of his rope, he couldn't get back. Mrs. Bukowski was out shopping somewhere, so she was no help. When she got home, she found her dog lying at the base of the tree in her side yard, choked to death. The writing on the sidewalk stayed there for about a week. Then it rained hard, and afterward there was just a pink blur. But until it rained, it stayed pretty sharp, and while it was sharp, no one walked on it. I saw this for myself. People, kids walking to school, ladies walking downtown, Mr. Schermerhorn, the mailman, would just kind of veer around it. They didn't even seem to know they were doing it, and nobody ever talked about it either, like, what's up with this weird shit on the sidewalk, or what do you suppose you call something that looks like that? A fowder, dimbulb. It was as if they didn't even see it was there. Except part of them must have. Why else would they have walked around it? 10. I didn't tell Mr. Sharpton all that, but I told him what he wanted to know about Skipper. I decided I could trust him. Maybe that secret part of me knew I could trust him, but I don't think so. I think it was just the way he put his hand on my arm, like your dad would do. Not that I have a dad, but I can imagine. Plus, it was like he said, even if he was a cop and arrested me, what judge and jury would believe Skipper Brannigan had driven his car off the road because of a letter I sent him? Especially one full of nonsense words and symbols made up by a pizza delivery boy who had flunked high school geometry. Twice. When I was done, there was silence between us for a long time. At last, Mr. Sharpton said, "He deserved it. You know that, don't you?" And for some reason that did it. The dam burst and I cried like a baby. I must have cried for 15 minutes or more. Mr. Sharpton put his arm around me and pulled me against his chest, and I watered the lapel of his suit. If someone had driven by and seen us that way, they would have thought we were a couple of queers for sure, but nobody did. There was just him and me under the yellow mercury vapor lamps there by the cart corral.
Yippee-ti-yi-yo, get along, little shopping cart, Pug used to sing. For you know Super Saver will be your new home.
Oh, we'd laugh till we cried. At last I was able to turn off the waterworks. Mr. Sharpton handed me a hanky and I wiped my eyes with it.
How did you know? I asked.
My voice sounded all deep and weird, like a foghorn.
Once you were spotted, all it took was a little rudimentary detective work.
Yeah, but how was I spotted?
We have certain people, a dozen or so in all, who look for fellows and gals like you, he said. They can actually see fellows and gals like you, Dink, the way certain satellites in space can see nuclear piles and power plants. You folks show up yellow, like match flames, is how this one spotter described it to me.
He shook his head and gave me a wry little smile.
I'd like to see something like that just once in my life, or be able to do what you do. Of course, I'd also like to be given a day. Just one would be fine, when I could paint like Picasso, or write like Faulkner.
I gaped at him. Is that true? There are people who can see?
Yes, there are bloodhounds. They crisscross the country and all other countries looking for that bright yellow glow, looking for matchheads in the darkness. This particular young woman was on Route 90, actually headed for Pittsburgh to catch a plane home, to grab a little R&R when she saw you, or sensed you, or whatever it is they do. The finders don't really know themselves, any more than you really know what you did to Skipper, do you?
What?
He raised a hand.
I told you that you wouldn't get all the answers you'd like. This is something you'll have to decide on the basis of what you feel, not on what you know. But I can tell you a couple of things. To begin with, Dink, I work for an outfit called the Trans Corporation. Our job is getting rid of the world's Skipper Brannigans, the big ones, the ones who do it on a grand scale. We have company headquarters in Chicago and a training center in Peoria, where you'll spend a week if you agree to my proposal.
I didn't say anything then, but I knew already I was going to say yes to his proposal. Whatever it was, I was going to say yes.
You're a tranny, my young friend. Better get used to the idea.
What is it?
A trait. There are folks in our organization who think of what you have, what you can do, as a talent or an ability, or even a kind of glitch. But they're wrong. Talent and ability are born of trait. Trait is general. Talent and ability are specific.
You'll have to simplify that. I'm a high school dropout, remember?
I know, he said. I also know you didn't drop out because you were stupid. You dropped out because you didn't fit. In that way, you are like every other tranny I've ever met.
He laughed in the sharp way people do when they're not really amused.
All 21 of them. Now listen to me, and don't play dumb. Creativity is like a hand at the end of your arm. But a hand has many fingers, doesn't it?
Well, at least 5.
Think of those fingers as abilities. A creative person may write, paint, sculpt, or think up math formulae. He or she might dance or sing or play a musical instrument. Those are the fingers, but creativity is the hand that gives them life. And just as all hands are basically the same, form follows function, all creative people are the same once you get down to the place where the fingers join. Trans is also like a hand. Sometimes its fingers are called precognition, the ability to see the future. Sometimes they're postcognition, the ability to see the past. We have a guy who knows who killed John F. Kennedy. And it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. It was, in fact, a woman. There is telepathy, pyrokinesis, telepathy, and who knows how many others. We don't know, certainly. This is a new world, and we've barely begun to explore its first continent. But trans is different from creativity in one vital way. It's much rarer. One person in 800 is what occupational psychologists call gifted. We believe that there may only be one tranny in each 8 million people.
That took my breath away. The idea that you might be one in 8 million would take anybody's breath away, right?
That's about 120 for every billion ordinary folks, he said. We think there may be no more than 3,000 so-called trannies in the whole world. We're finding them, one by one. It's slow work. The sensing ability is fairly low level, but we still only have a dozen or so finders, and each one takes a lot of training. This is a hard calling, but it's also fabulously rewarding. We're finding trannies and we're putting them to work. That's what we want to do with you, Dink. Put you to work. We want to help you focus your talent, sharpen it, and use it for the betterment of all mankind. You won't be able to see any of your old friends again. There's no security risk on Earth like an old friend we've found. And there's not a whole lot of cash in it, at least to begin with. But there's a lot of satisfaction. And what I'm going to offer you is only the bottom rung of what may turn out to be a very high ladder.
Don't forget those fringe benefits, I said, kind of raising my voice on the last word, turning it into a question if you wanted to take it that way. He grinned and clapped me on the shoulder.
That's right, he said. Those famous fringe benefits.
By then I was starting to get excited. My doubts weren't gone, but they were melting away. So tell me about it, I said. My heart was beating hard, but it wasn't fear. Not anymore. Make me an offer I can't refuse. And that's just what he did. 11. 3 weeks later, I'm on an airplane for the first time in my life. And what a way to lose your cherry. The only passenger in a Lear 35... listening to Counting Crows pouring out of quad speakers with a Coke in one hand, watching as the altimeter climbs all the way to 42,000 feet. That's over a mile higher than most commercial jetliners fly, the pilot told me. And a ride as smooth as the seat of a girl's underpants. I spent a week in Peoria and I was homesick. Really homesick. Surprised the shit out of me. There were a couple of nights when I even cried myself to sleep. I'm ashamed to say that, but I've been truthful so far, and I don't want to start lying or leaving things out now. Ma was the least of what I missed. You'd think we would have been close, as it was us against the world, in a manner of speaking, but my mother was never much for loving and comforting. She didn't whip on my head or put out her cigarettes in my armpits or anything like that, but so what? I mean, big whoop. I've never had any kids, so I guess I can't say for sure. But I somehow don't think being a great parent is about the stuff you don't do to your rug monkeys. Ma was always more into her friends than me and her weekly trip to the beauty shop and Friday nights out of the reservation. Her big ambition in life was to win a 20-number bingo and drive home in a brand new Monte Carlo. I'm not sitting on the pity pot either, I'm just telling you how it was. Mr. Sharpton called Ma and told her that I'd been chosen to intern in the Trans Corporation's Advanced Computer Training and Placement Project, a special deal for non-diploma kids with potential. The story was actually pretty believable. I was a shitty math student and froze up almost completely in classes like English, where you were supposed to talk. But I was always on good terms with the school computers. In fact, although I don't like to brag, and I never let any of the faculty in on this little secret, I could program rings around Mr. Jackaboy and Mrs. Wilcoxon. I never cared much about computer games. They're strictly for dick brains, in my humble opinion, but I could keyjack like a mad motherfucker. Pug used to drop by and watch me sometimes. I can't believe you, he once said. Man, you got that thing smoking and toking. I shrugged. Any fool can peel the apple, I said. It takes a real man to eat the core. So Ma believed it. She might have had a few more questions if she knew the Trans Corporation was flying me out to Illinois in a private jet, but she didn't. And I didn't miss her all that much. But I missed Pug and John Cassaday, who was our other friend from our Super Saver days. John plays bass in a punk band, wears a gold ring in his left eyebrow, and has just about every sub-pop record ever made. He cried when Kurt Cobain ate the dirt sandwich, didn't try to hide it or blame it on allergies either, just said, "I'm sad because Kurt died." John's eventual. And I missed Harkerville. Perverse but true. Being at the training center in Peoria was like being born again somehow. And I guess being born always hurts. I thought I might meet some other people like me. If this was a book or a movie, or maybe just an episode of The X-Files, I would meet a cute chick with nifty little tits and the ability to shut doors from across the room. But that didn't happen. I'm pretty sure there were other trannies at Peoria when I was there, but Dr. Wentworth and the other folks running the place were careful to keep us separated. I once asked why and got a runaround. That's when I started to realize that not everybody who had TransCore printed on their shirts or walked around with TransCore clipboards was my pal or wanted to be my long-lost dad. And it was about killing people. That's what I was training for. The folks in Peoria didn't talk about that all the time, but no one tried to sugarcoat it either. I just had to remember the targets were bad guys, dictators and spies and serial killers. And as Mr. Sharpton said, people did it in wars all the time. Plus, it wasn't personal. No guns, no knives, no garrots. I never get blood splashed on me. Like I told you, I never saw Mr. Sharpton again, at least not yet. I haven't, but I talked to him every day of the week I was in Peoria, and that eased the pain and strangeness considerably. Talking to him was like having someone put a cool cloth on your brow. He gave me his number the night we talked in his Mercedes and told me to call him any time, even at 3 a.m. if I was feeling upset. Once I did just that. I almost hung up on the second ring because people may say call them any time, even at 3 a.m, but they don't really expect you to do it. But I hung in there. I was homesick, yeah, but it was more than that. The place wasn't what I had expected exactly, and I wanted to tell Mr. Sharpton so. See how he took it, kind of. He answered on the third ring, and although he sounded sleepy, big surprise there, huh? He didn't sound at all pissed. I told him that some of the stuff they were doing was quite weird. The test with all the flashing lights, for example. They said it was a test for epilepsy, but I went to sleep right in the middle of it, I said. And when I woke up, I had a headache and it was hard to think. You know what I felt like? A file cabinet after someone's been rummaging through it. What's your point, Dink? Mr. Sharpton asked. I think they hypnotized me, I said. A brief pause, then, maybe they did. Probably they did. But why? Why would they? I'm doing everything they ask, so why would they want to hypnotize me? I don't know all their routines and protocols, but I suspect they're programming you, putting a lot of housekeeping stuff on the lower levels of your mind so they won't have to junk up the conscious part and maybe screw up your special ability while they're at it. Really no different than programming a computer's hard disk, and no more sinister. But you don't know for sure. No. As I say, training and testing are not my purview. But I'll make some calls, and Dr. Wentworth will talk to you. It may even be that an apology is due. If that's the case, Dink, you may be sure that it will be tendered. Our trannies are too rare and too valuable to be upset needlessly. Now, is there anything else? I thought about it, then said no. I thanked him and hung up. It had been on the tip of my tongue to tell him I thought I'd been drugged as well, given some sort of mood elevator to help me through the worst of my homesickness. But in the end, I decided not to bother him. It was 3 a.m, after all, and if they had been giving me anything, it was probably for my own good. 12. Dr. Wentworth came to see me the next day. He was the big kahuna, and he did apologize. He was perfectly nice about it, but he had a look. I don't know, like maybe Mr. Sharpton had called him about 2 minutes after I hung up and gave him a hot reaming. Dr. Wentworth took me for a walk on the back lawn, green and rolling and damn near perfect there at the end of spring. and said he was sorry for not keeping me up to speed. The epilepsy test really was an epilepsy test, he said, and a CAT scan too, but since it induced a hypnotic state in most subjects, they usually took advantage of it to give certain baseline instructions. In my case, they were instructions about the computer programs I'd be using in Columbia City. Dr. Wentworth asked me if I had any other questions. I lied and said no. You probably think that's weird, but it's not. I mean, I had a long and sucky school career which ended 3 months short of graduation. I had teachers I liked as well as teachers I hated, but never one I entirely trusted. I was the kind of kid who always sat in the back of the room if the teacher's seating chart wasn't alphabetical and never took part in class discussions. I mostly said, huh, when I was called on, and wild horses wouldn't have dragged a question out of me. Mr. Sharpton was the only guy I ever met who was able to get into where I lived, and old Doc Wentworth with his bald head and sharp eyes behind his little rimless glasses was no Mr. Sharpton. I could imagine pigs flying south for the winter before I could imagine opening up to that dude, let alone crying on his shoulder. And fuck, I didn't know what else to ask anyway. A lot of the time I liked it in Peoria, and I was excited by the prospects ahead. New job, new house, new town. People were great to me in Peoria. Even the food was great. Meatloaf, fried chicken, milkshakes, everything I liked. Okay, I didn't like the diagnostic test, those booger snots you have to do with an IBM pencil, and sometimes I'd feel dopey, as if someone had put something in my mashed potatoes. Or hyper, sometimes I'd feel that way too. And there were other times, at least two, when I was pretty sure I'd been hypnotized again. But so what? I mean, was any of it a big deal after you'd been chased around a supermarket parking lot by a maniac who was laughing and making race car noises and trying to run you over with a shopping cart? 13. I had one more talk on the phone with Mr. Sharpton that I suppose I should mention. That was just a day before my second airplane ride, the one that took me to Columbia City, where a guy was waiting with the keys to my new house. By then, I knew about the cleaners and the basic money rule. Start every week broke, end every week broke. And I knew who to call locally if I had a problem. Any big problem, and I call Mr. Sharpton, who is technically my control. I had maps, a list of restaurants, directions to the cinema complex and the mall. I had a line on everything, but the most important thing of all. Mr. Sharpton, I don't know what to do, I said. I was talking to him on the phone just outside the cafe. There was a phone in my room, but by then I was too nervous to sit down, let alone lie on my bed. If they were still putting shit in my food, it sure wasn't working that day. I can't help you there, Dink, he said, calm as ever. So, Sully, Charlie. What do you mean? You've got to help me. You recruited me, for jeepers' sake. Let me give you a hypothetical case. Suppose I'm the president of a well-endowed college. Do you know what well-endowed means? Lots of bucks. I'm not stupid. I told you that. So you did. I apologize. Anyhow, let's say that I, President Sharpton, use some of my school's plentiful bucks to hire a great novelist as the writer in residence, or a great pianist to teach music. Would that entitle me to tell the novelist what to write, or the pianist what to compose? Probably not. Absolutely not. But let's say it did. If I told the novelist, write a comedy about Betsy Ross screwing around with George Washington in Gay Paris, do you think he could do it? I got laughing. I couldn't help it. Mr. Sharpton's just got a vibe about him somehow. Maybe, I said. Especially if you whipped a bonus on the guy. Okay, but even if he held his nose and cranked it out, it would likely be a very bad novel, because creative people aren't always in charge, and when they do their best work, they're hardly ever in charge. They're just sort of rolling along with their eyes shut, yelling, "Wee!" What's all that got to do with me? Listen, Mr. Sharpton, when I try to imagine what I'm going to do in Columbia City, all I see is a great big blank. Help people, you said, make the world a better place, get rid of the skippers. All that sounds great, except I don't know how to do it. You will, he said. When the time comes, you will. You said Wentworth and his guys would focus my talent. sharpen it. Mostly what they did was give me a bunch of stupid tests and make me feel like I was back in school. Is it all in my subconscious? Is it all on the hard disk?
Trust me, Ding, he said. Trust me and trust yourself.
So I did. I have. But just lately, things haven't been so good. Not so good at all. That goddamn Neff. All the bad stuff started with him. I wish I'd never seen his picture. And if I had to see a picture, I wish I'd seen one where he wasn't smiling. 14. My first week in Columbia City, I did nothing. I mean, absolutely zilch. I didn't even go to the movies. When the cleaners came, I just went to the park and sat on a bench and felt like the whole world was watching me. When it came time to get rid of my extra money on Thursday, I ended up shredding better than $50 in the garbage disposal. And doing that was new to me then, remember? Talk about feeling weird. Man, you don't have a clue. While I was standing there listening to the motor under the sink grinding away, I kept thinking about Ma. If Ma had been there to see what I was doing, she would have probably run me through with a butcher knife to make me stop. That was a dozen 20-number bingo games, or two dozen coveralls, going straight down the kitchen pig. I slept like shit that week. Every now and then I'd go to the little study. I didn't want to, but my feet would drag me there. Like they say, murderers always return to the scenes of their crimes, I guess. Anyway, I'd stand there in the doorway and look at the dark computer screen at the Global Village modem, and I'd just sweat with guilt and embarrassment and fear. Even the way the desk was so neat and clean without a single paper or note on it made me sweat. I could just about hear the walls muttering stuff like, "Nah, nothing's going on in here. And who's this turkey, the cable installer?" I had nightmares. In one of them, the doorbell rings, and when I open it, Mr. Sharpton's there. He's got a pair of handcuffs.
"Put out your wrist, Dink," he says. "We thought you were a tranny, but obviously we were wrong. Sometimes it happens."
"No, I am," I say. "I am a tranny. I just need a little more time to get acclimated. I've never been away from home before, remember?"
"You've had 5 years," he goes.
I'm stunned. I can't believe it, but part of me knows it's true. It feels like days, but it's really been 5 fucking years. And I haven't turned on the computer in the little study a single time. If not for the cleaners, the desk it sits on would be 6 inches deep in dust.
"Hold out your hands, Dink. Stop making this hard on both of us."
"I won't," I say. "And you can't make me." He looks behind him then, and who should come up the steps but Skipper Brannigan. He's wearing his red nylon tunic, only now Transcorp is sewn on it instead of Super Saver. He looked pale, but otherwise okay. Not dead is what I mean. "You thought you did something to me, but you didn't," Skipper says. "You couldn't do anything to anyone. You're just a hippie waste."
"I'm going to put these cuffs on him," Mr. Sharpton says to Skipper. "If he gives me any trouble, run him over with a shopping cart."
"Totally eventual," Skipper says. And I wake up half out of my bed and on the floor, screaming. 15. Then about 10 days after I moved in, I had another kind of dream. I don't remember what it was, but it must have been a good one because when I woke up, I was smiling. I could feel it on my face, a big, happy smile. It was like when I woke up with the idea about Mrs. Bukowski's dog, almost exactly like that. I pulled on a pair of jeans and went into the study. I turned on the computer and opened the window marked Tools. There's a program in there called Dinky's Notebook. I went right to it and all my symbols were there. Circles, triangles, chaps, mercs, rhomboids, bues, smims, fouders. Hundreds more, thousands more, maybe millions more. It's sort of like Mr. Sharpton said, a new world, and I'm on the coastline of the first continent. All I know is that all at once it was there for me. I had a great big Macintosh computer to work with instead of a little piece of pink chalk,
and all I had to do was type the words for the symbols and the symbols would appear. I was jacked to the max. I mean, my God! It was like a river of fire burning in the middle of my head. I wrote, I called up symbols, I used the mouse to drag everything where it was supposed to be. And when it was done, I had a letter. One of the special letters. But a letter to who? A letter to where? Then I realized it didn't matter. Make a few minor customizing touches, and there were many people the letter could go to, although this one had been written for a man rather than a woman. I don't know how I knew that, I just did. I decided to start with Cincinnati, only because Cincinnati was the first city to come into my mind. It could as easily have been Zurich, Switzerland, or Waterville, Maine. I tried to open a tools program titled Dinky Mail. Before the computer would let me in there, it prompted me to wake up my modem. Once the modem was running, the computer wanted a 312 area code. 312 Chicago, and I imagine that, as far as the phone company is concerned, my CompuCalls all come from TransCorp's headquarters. I didn't care one way or another. That was their business. I had found my business and was taking care of it. With the modem awake and linked to Chicago, the computer flashed Dinky Mail ready. I clicked on Locale. I'd been in the study almost 3 hours by then, with only one break to take a quick piss, and I could smell myself, sweating and stinking like a monkey in a greenhouse. I didn't mind. I liked the smell. I was having the time of my life. I was fucking delirious. I typed Cincinnati and hit execute. No listing Cincinnati, the computer said. Okay, not a problem. Try Columbus, closer to home anyway. And yes, folks, we have a bingo. Two listings Columbus. There were two telephone numbers. I clicked on the top one, curious and a little afraid of what might pop out. But it wasn't a dossier or a profile or, God forbid, a photograph. There was one single word. Muffin. Say what? But then I knew. Muffin was Mr. Columbus's pet. Very likely a cat. I called up my special letter again, transposed two symbols, and deleted a third. Then I added Muffin to the top with an arrow pointing down. There. Perfect. Did I wonder who Muffin's owner was, or what he had done to warrant TransCorp's attention, or exactly what was going to happen to him? I did not. The idea that my conditioning at Peoria might have been partially responsible for this disinterest never crossed my mind, either. I was doing my thing, that was all. Just doing my thing and as happy as a clam at high tide. I called the number on the screen. I had the computer speaker on, but there was no hello, only the screechy mating call of another computer. Just as well, really. Life's easier when you subtract the human element. Then it's like that movie, 12 o'clock high, cruising over Berlin in your trusty B-52, looking through your trusty Norden bomb sight and waiting for just the right moment to push your trusty button. You might see smokestacks or factory roofs, but no people. The guys who dropped the bombs from their B-52s didn't have to hear the screams of mothers whose children had just been reduced to guts. And I didn't even have to hear anyone say hello. A very good deal. After a little bit, I turned off the speaker anyway. I found it distracting. Modem found, the computer flashed, and then search for email address Y/N. I typed Y and waited. This time the wait was longer. I think the computer was going back to Chicago again and getting what it needed to unlock the email address of Mr. Columbus. Still, it was less than 30 seconds before the computer is right back at me with email address found. Send dinky mail Y/N. I typed Y with absolutely no hesitation. The computer flashed, sending dinky mail, and then dinky mail sent. That was all. No fireworks. I wonder what happened to Muffin, though. You know, after. 16. That night I called Mr. Sharpton and said, I'm working. That's good, Dink. Great news. Feel better? Calm as ever. Mr. Sharpton is like the weather in Tahiti. Yeah, I said. The fact was, I felt blissful. It was the best day of my life. Doubts or no doubts, worries or no worries, I still say that. The most eventual day of my life. It was like a river of fire in my head. A fucking river of fire, can you get that? Do you feel better, Mr. Sharpton? Relieved? I'm happy for you, but I can't say I'm relieved because you were never worried in the first place. Got it in one, he said. Everything's eventual, in other words. He laughed at that. He always laughs when I say that. That's right, Dink. Everything's eventual. Mr. Sharpton? Yes? Email's not exactly private, you know. Anybody who's really dedicated can hack into it. Part of what you send is a suggestion that the recipient delete the message from all files, is it not? Yes, but I can't absolutely guarantee that I'll do it, or she. Even if they don't, nothing can happen to someone else who chances on such a message, am I correct? Because it's personalized. Well, it might give someone a headache, but that would be about all. And the communication itself would look like so much gibberish. Or a code. He laughed heartily at that. Let them try to break it, Dinky, eh? Just let them try. I sighed. I suppose. Let's discuss something more important, Dink. How did it feel? Fucking wonderful. Good. Don't question wonder, Dink. Don't ever question wonder. And he hung up. 17. Sometimes I have to send actual letters. Print out the stuff I womp up in Dinky's notebook, stick it in an envelope, lick stamps, and mail it off to somebody somewhere. Professor Ann Tevich, University of New Mexico at Las Cruces. Mr. Andrew Neff, care of the New York Post, New York, New York. Billy Younger, General Delivery, Stovington, Vermont. Only names, but they were still more upsetting than the phone numbers. More personal than the phone numbers. It was like seeing faces swim up at you for a second inside your Norden bomb sight. I mean, what a freak out, right? You're up there at 25,000 feet, no faces allowed up there, but sometimes one shows up for a second or two just the same. I wondered how a university professor could get along without a modem, or a guy whose address was a fucking New York newspaper for that matter. But I never wondered too much, I didn't have to. We live in a modern world, but letters don't have to be sent by computer after all. There's still snail mail, and the stuff I really needed was always in the database. The fact that Unger had a 1957 Thunderbird, for instance, or that Ann Tevich had a loved one, perhaps her husband, perhaps her son, perhaps her father, named Simon. And people like Tevich and Unger were exceptions. Most of the folks I reach out and touch are like that first one in Columbus. Fully equipped for the 21st century. Sending dinky mail sent. Very good. So long, Charlie. I could have gone on like that for a long time, maybe forever, browsing the database. There's no schedule to follow, no list of primary cities and targets. I'm completely on my own, unless all that shit is also in my subconscious, down there on the hard disk. Going to afternoon movies, enjoying the ma-less silence of my little house, and dreaming of my next step up the ladder. Except I woke up feeling horny one day. I worked for an hour or so browsing around in Australia, but it was no good. My dick kept trespassing on my brain, so to speak. I shut off the computer and went down to News Plus to see if I could find a magazine featuring pretty ladies in frothy lingerie. As I got there, a guy was coming out reading the Columbus Dispatch. I never read the paper myself. Why bother? It's the same old shit, day in and day out. Dictators beating the ching-chong out of people weaker than they are. Men in uniforms beating the ching-chong out of soccer balls or footballs. Politicians kissing babies and kissing ass. Mostly stories about the Skipper Brannigans of the world, in other words. and I wouldn't have seen this story even if I'd happened to look at the newspaper display rack once I got inside, because it was on the bottom half of the front page, below the fold. But this fucking dimbulb comes out with the paper hanging open and his face buried inside it. In the lower right corner was a picture of a white-haired guy smoking a pipe and smiling. He looked like a good-humored fuck, probably Irish, eyes all crinkled up and these white bushy eyebrows. And the headline over the photo, not a big one, but you could read it, said, "Neff suicide still puzzles, grieves colleagues." For a second or two, I thought I'd just skip News Plus that day. I didn't feel like ladies in lingerie after all. Maybe I'd just go home and take a nap. If I went in, I'd probably pick up a copy of the Dispatch. Wouldn't be able to help myself, and I wasn't sure I wanted to know any more about that Irish-looking guy than I already did, which was nothing at all, as you can fucking believe, I hastened to tell myself. Neff couldn't be that weird a name anyway, only 4 letters. Not like Shittin' Dukas or Whorecake. There must be thousands of Neffs if you're talking coast to coast. This one didn't have to be the Neff I knew about, the one who loved Frank Sinatra records. It would be better, in any case, to just leave and come back tomorrow. Tomorrow, the picture of that guy with the pipe would be gone. Tomorrow, somebody else's picture would be there on the lower right corner of page 1. People are always dying, right? People who aren't superstars or anything, just famous enough to get their pictures down there in the lower right corner of page 1. And sometimes people were puzzled about it, the way folks back home in Harkerville had been puzzled about Skipper's death. No alcohol in his blood. Clear night, dry road, not the suicidal type. The world is full of mysteries like that, though, and sometimes it's best not to solve them. Sometimes the solutions aren't, you know, too eventual. But willpower has never been my strong point. I can't always keep away from the chocolate, even though I know my skin doesn't like it, and I couldn't keep away from the Columbus Dispatch that day. I went on inside and bought one. I started home, then had a funny thought. The funny thought was that I didn't want a newspaper with Andrew Neff's picture on the front page going out with my trash. The trash pickup guys came in a city truck. Surely they couldn't have anything to do with TransCorp, but there was this show me and Pug used to watch one summer back when we were little kids. Golden Years, it was called. You probably don't remember it. Anyway, there was a guy on that show who used to say, "Perfect paranoia is perfect awareness." It was like his motto. And I sort of believe that. Anyway, I went to the park instead of back home. I sat on a bench and read the story, and when I was done, I stuck the paper in a park trash barrel. I didn't even like doing that, but hey, if Mr. Sharpton has got a guy following me around and checking on every little thing I throw away, I'm fucked up the wazoo no matter what. There was no doubt that Andrew Neff, age 62, a columnist for the New York Post since 1970, had committed suicide. He took a bunch of pills that probably would have done the trick, then climbed into his bathtub, put a plastic bag over his head, and rounded the evening off by slitting his wrists. There was a man totally dedicated to avoiding counseling. He left no note, though, and the autopsy showed no signs of disease. His colleagues scoffed at the idea of Alzheimer's or even early senility. "He was the sharpest guy I've ever known, right up to the day he died," a guy named Pete Hamill said. "He could have gone on Challenge Jeopardy and run both boards. I have no idea why Andy did such a thing." Hamill went on to say that one of Neff's charming oddities was his complete refusal to participate in the computer revolution. No modems for him, no laptop word processor, no handheld spell checker from Franklin Electronic Publishers. He didn't even have a CD player in his apartment, Hamill said. Neff claimed, perhaps only half-joking, that compact discs were the devil's work. He loved the chairman of the board, but only on vinyl. This guy Hamill and several others said Neff was unfailingly cheerful, right up to the afternoon he filed his last column, went home, drank a glass of wine, and then demoed himself. One of the Post's chatter columnists, Liz Smith, said she'd shared a piece of pie with him just before he left on that last day, and Neff had seemed a trifle distracted, but otherwise fine. Distracted, sure, With a head full of Fowders, Bews, and Smims, you'd be distracted, too. Neff, the piece went on, had been something of an anomaly on the Post, which sticks up for the more conservative view of life. I guess they don't come right out and recommend electrocuting welfare recipients after 3 years and still no job, but they do hint that it's always an option. I guess Neff was the House liberal. He wrote a column called Enough is Enough, and in it he talked about changing the way New York treated single teen mothers, suggested that maybe abortion wasn't always murder, argued that the low-income housing in the outer boroughs was a self-perpetuating hate machine. Near the end of his life, he'd been writing columns about the size of the military and asking why we as a country felt we had to keep pouring on the bucks when there was, essentially, no one left to fight except for the terrorists. He said we'd do better to spend that money creating jobs. And Post readers, who would have crucified anyone else saying stuff like that, pretty much loved it when Neff laid it down. Because he was funny, because he was charming. Maybe because he was Irish and had kissed the Blarney Stone. That was about all. I started home. Somewhere along the way, I took a detour, though, and ended up walking all over downtown. I zigged and zagged, walking down boulevards and cutting through parking lots, all the time thinking about Andrew Neff climbing into his bathtub and putting a baggie over his head. A big one, a gallon size, keeps all your leftovers supermarket fresh. He was funny. He was charming. And I had killed him. Neff had opened my letter and it had gotten into his head somehow. Judging by what I'd read in the paper, the special words and symbols took maybe 3 days to fuck him up enough to swallow the pills and climb into the tub. He deserved it. That's what Mr. Sharpton said about Skipper, and maybe he was right. That time. But did Neff deserve it? Was there shit about him I didn't know? Did he maybe like little girls in the wrong way, or push dope, or go after people too weak to fight back, like Skipper had gone after me with the shopping cart? "We want to help you use your talent for the betterment of all mankind," Mr. Sharpton said. And surely that didn't mean making a guy off himself because he thought the Defense Department was spending too much money on smart bombs. Paranoid shit like that is strictly for movies starring Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme. Then I had a bad idea. A scary idea. Maybe Transcorp didn't want him dead because he wrote that stuff. Maybe they wanted him dead because people, the wrong people, were starting to think about what he wrote. "That's crazy," I said right out loud. And a woman looking into the window of Columbia City, oh so pretty, turned around and gave me the old fisheye. I ended up at the public library around 2 o'clock with my legs aching and my head throbbing. I kept seeing that guy in the bathtub with his wrinkled old man's tits and white chest hair, his nice smile gone, replaced by this vague Planet X look. I kept seeing him putting a baggie over his head, humming a Sinatra tune, My Way, maybe, as he snugged it down tight, then peered through it the way you'd peer through a cloudy window, so he could see to slit the veins in his wrists. I didn't want to see that stuff, but I couldn't stop. My bomb sight had turned into a telescope. They had a computer room in the library, and you could get on the internet at a very reasonable cost. I had to get a library card, too, but that was okay. A library card is good to have. You can never have too much ID. It took me only $3 worth of time to find Ann Tevich and call up the report of her death. The story started, I saw with a sinking sensation, in the bottom right-hand corner of page 1, the official dead folks nook, and then jumped to the obituary page. Professor Tevich had been a pretty lady, blonde, 37. In the photo, she was holding her glasses in her hand, as if she wanted people to know she wore them, but as if she'd wanted people to see what pretty eyes she had, too. That made me feel sad and guilty. Her death was startlingly like Skipper's. Coming home from her office at UNM just after dark, maybe hurrying a little because it was her turn to make supper, but what the hell? Good driving conditions and great visibility. Her car, vanity license plate DNA fan, I happen to know, had veered off the road, overturned, and landed in a dry wash. She was still alive when someone spotted the headlights and found her, but there had never been any real hope. Her injuries were too grave. There was no alcohol in her system, and her marriage was in good shape. No kids, at least, thank God for small favors. So the idea of suicide was far-fetched. She had been looking forward to the future. She even talked about getting a computer to celebrate a new research grant. She'd refused to own a PC since 1988 or so, had lost some valuable data in one when it locked up, and had distrusted them ever since. She would use her department's equipment when she absolutely had to, but that was all. The coroner's verdict had been accidental death. Professor Ann Tevich, a clinical biologist, had been in the forefront of West Coast AIDS research. Another scientist, this one in California, said that her death might set back the search for a cure 5 years. She was a key player, he said. Smart, yes, but more. I once heard someone refer to her as a natural-born facilitator, and that's as good a description as any. Anne was the kind of person who holds other people together. Her death is a great loss to the dozens of people who knew and loved her, but it's an even greater loss to this cause. Billy Unger was also easy enough to find. His picture topped page one of the Stovington Weekly Current, instead of getting stuck down there in the dead folks' nook, but that might have been because there weren't many famous people in Stovington. Unger had been General William Rollum Unger, winner of the Silver Star and Bronze Star in Korea. During the Kennedy administration, he was an Undersecretary of Defense, Acquisition Reform, and one of the really big war hawks of that time. Kill the Ruskies, drink their blood, keep America safe for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, that sort of thing. Then, around the time Lyndon Johnson was escalating the war in Vietnam, Billy Unger had a change of mind and heart. He began writing letters to newspapers. He started his op-ed page career by saying that we were handling the war wrong. He progressed to the idea that we were wrong to be in Vietnam at all. Then around 1975 or so, he got to the point of saying all wars were wrong. That was okay with most Vermonters. He served 7 terms in the state legislature, starting in 1978 when a group of progressive Democrats asked him to run for the U.S. Senate in 1996. He said he wanted to do some reading and consider his options. The implication was that he would be ready for a national career in politics by 2000, 2002 at the latest. He was getting old, but Vermonters like old guys, I guess. 1996 went past without Unger declaring himself a candidate for anything, possibly because his wife died of cancer. And before 2002 came around, he bought himself a big old dirt sandwich and ate every bite. There's a small but loyal contingent in Stovington which claimed Rollum's death was an accident. That Silver Star winners don't jump off their roofs, even if they have lost a wife to cancer in the last year or so. But the rest pointed out that the guy probably hadn't been repairing the shingles. Not in his nightshirt, not at 2 o'clock in the morning. Suicide was the verdict. Yeah, right. Kiss my ass and go to heaven. 18. I left the library and thought I'd head home. Instead, I went back to the same park bench again. I sat there until the sun was low and the place had pretty much emptied out of kids and frisbee-catching dogs. And although I'd been in Columbia City for 3 months by then, it was the latest I'd ever been out. That's sad, I guess. I thought I was living a life here, finally getting away from Ma and living a life, but all I've been doing is throwing a shadow. If people, certain people, were checking up on me, they might wonder why the change in routine. So I got up, went on home, boiled up a bag of that shit on a shingle stuff, and turned on my TV. I've got cable, the full package, including premium movie channels, and I've never seen a single bill. How's that for an eventual deal? I turned on Cinemax. Rutger Hauer was playing a blind karate fighter. I sat down on the couch beneath my fake Rembrandt and watched the show. I didn't see it, but I ate my chow and looked at it. I thought about stuff. About a newspaper columnist who had liberal ideas and a conservative readership. About an AIDS researcher who served an important linking function with other AIDS researchers. About an old general who changed his mind. I thought about the fact that I only knew these three by name because they didn't have modems and email capability.
There was other stuff to think about, too. Like how you could hypnotize a talented guy or drug him, or maybe even expose him to other talented guys in order to keep him from asking any of the wrong questions or doing any of the wrong things. Like how you could make sure such a talented guy couldn't run away even if he happened to wake up to the truth. You do that by setting him up in what was essentially a cashless existence. A life where rule number one was no rat-holing any extra dough, not even pocket change. What sort of talented guy would fall for something like that? A naive one, with few friends and next to no self-image. A guy who would sell you his talented soul for a few groceries and 70 bucks a week because he believes that's about what it's worth. I didn't want to think about any of that. I tried to concentrate on Rutger Hauer, doing all that amusing blind karate shit. Pug would have laughed his ass off if he'd been there, believe me. So I wouldn't have to think about any of that. 200, for instance. There was a number I didn't want to think about. 200. 10 times 20, 40 times 5. CC to the old Romans. At least 200 times I'd push the button that brought the message Dinky Mail sent up on my screen. It occurred to me, for the first time as if I was finally waking up, that I was a murderer. A mass murderer. Yes, indeed. That's what it comes down to. Good of mankind, bad of mankind, indifferent of mankind. Who makes those judgments? Mr. Sharpton? His bosses, their bosses, and does it matter? I decided it didn't matter a fuck in a rabbit hutch. I further decided I really couldn't spend too much time moaning, even to myself, how I had been drugged, hypnotized, or exposed to some kind of mind control. The truth was, I'd been doing what I was doing because I loved the feeling I got when I was composing the special letters. The feeling that there was a river of fire running through the center of my head. Mostly, I'd been doing it because I could. That's not true, I said, but not real loud. I whispered it under my breath. They probably don't have any bugs planted here. I'm sure they don't, but it's best to be safe. I started writing this. What is it? A report, maybe. I started writing this report later that night, as soon as the Rutger Hauer movie was over, in fact. I write in a notebook, though, not on my computer, and I write in plain old English. No sankophytes, no bues, no smims. There's a loose floor tile under the ping-pong table down in the basement. That's where I keep my report. I just now look back at how I started. I've got a good job now, I wrote. And no reason to feel glum. Idiotic. But of course, any fool who can pucker is apt to whistle past the graveyard. When I went to bed that night, I dreamed I was in the parking lot of the Super Saver. Pug was there wearing his red duster and a hat on his head like the one Mickey Mouse wore in Fantasia. That's the movie where Mickey played the sorcerer's apprentice. Halfway across the parking lot, shopping carts were lined up in a row. Pug would raise his hand, then lower it. Each time he did this, a cart would start rolling by itself, gathering speed, rushing across the lot until it crashed into the brick side of the supermarket. They were piling up there, a glittering junk heap of metal and wheels. For once in his life, Pug wasn't smiling. I wanted to ask him what he was doing and what it meant, but of course I knew. "He's been good to me," I told Pug in this dream. It was Mr. Sharpton I meant, of course. "He's been really, really eventual." Pug turned fully to me then, and I saw it wasn't Pug at all. It was Skipper, and his head had been smashed in all the way down to the eyebrows. Shattered hunks of skull stuck up in a circle, making him look like he was wearing a bone crown. "You're not looking through a bomb sight," Skipper said and grinned. "You are the bomb sight. How do you like that, Dinkster?" I woke up in the dark of my room, sweating, with my hands over my mouth to hold in a scream. So I guess I didn't like it very much. 19. Writing this has been a sad education, let me tell you. It's like, "Hey, Dink, welcome to the real world." Mostly it's the image of grinding up dollar bills and the kitchen pig that comes to me when I think about what has happened to me. But I know that's only because it's easier to think of grinding up money or chucking it into the storm drain
than it is to think about grinding up people. Sometimes I hate myself. Sometimes I'm scared for my immortal soul, if I have one. And sometimes I'm just embarrassed. Trust me, Mr. Sharpton said, and I did. I mean, duh. How dumb can you get? I tell myself I'm just a kid, the same age as the kids who crewed those B-52s I sometimes think about, that kids are allowed to be dumb, but I wonder if that's true when lives are at stake. And of course, I'm still doing it. Yes. I thought at first that I wouldn't be able to, no more than the kids in Mary Poppins could keep floating around the house when they lost their happy thoughts. But I could. And once I sat down in front of the computer screen and that river of fire started to flow, I was lost. You see, at least I think you do. This is what I was put on planet Earth for. Can I be blamed for doing the thing that finishes me off, that completes me? Answer, yes. Absolutely. But I can't stop. Sometimes I tell myself that I've gone on because if I do stop, maybe even for a day, they'll know I've caught on. And the cleaners will make an unscheduled stop. Except what they'll clean up this time will be me. But that's not why. I do it because I'm just another addict. Same as a guy smoking crack in an alley or some chick taking a spike in her arm. I do it because of the hateful fucking rush. I do it because when I'm working in Dinky's notebook, everything's eventual. It's like being caught in a candy trap. And it's all the fault of that dork who came out of News Plus with his fucking dispatch open. If not for him, I'd still see nothing but cloud, hazy buildings and the crosshairs. No people, just targets. You are the bomb site, Skipper said in my dream. You are the bomb site, Dinkster. That's true. I know it is. Horrible, but true. I'm just another tool. Just the lens the real bombardier looks through. Just the button he pushes. What bombardier, you ask? Oh, come on, get real. I thought of calling him. How's that for crazy? Or maybe it's not.
Call me anytime, Dink. Even 3 in the morning.
That's what the man said, and I'm pretty sure that's what the man meant. About that, at least Mr. Sharpton wasn't lying. I thought of calling him and saying, You want to know what hurts the most, Mr. Sharpton? That thing you said about how I could make the world a better place by getting rid of people like Skipper. The truth is, you're the guys like Skipper. Sure, and I'm the shopping cart they chase people with, laughing and barking and making race car sounds. I work cheap, too, at bargain basement rates. So far, I've killed over 200 people, and what did it cost TransCorp? A little house in a third-rate Ohio town, $70 a week, and a Honda automobile, plus cable TV. Don't want to forget that. I stood there for a while, looking at the telephone, then put it down again. Couldn't say any of that. It would be the same as putting a baggie over my head and then slitting my wrists. So what am I going to do? Oh, God. What am I going to do? 20. It's been 2 weeks since I last took this notebook out from under the basement tile and wrote in it. Twice I've heard the mail slot clack on Thursdays during As the World Turns and gone out into the hall to get my money. I've gone to 4 movies, all in the afternoon. Twice I've ground up money in the kitchen pig and thrown my loose change down the storm drain, hiding what I was doing behind the blue plastic recycling basket when I put it down on the curb. One day I went down to News Plus, thinking I'd get a copy of Variations or Forum. There was a headline on the front of the dispatch that, once again, took away any sexy feelings I might have had. Pope dies of heart attack on peace mission, it said. Did I do it? Nah, the story said he died in Asia, and I've been sticking to the American Northwest these last few weeks. But I could have been the one. If I'd been nosing around in Pakistan last week, I very likely would have been the one. 2 weeks of living in a nightmare. Then, this morning, there was something in the mail. Not a letter, I've only gotten 3 or 4 of those, all from Pug, and now he's stopped writing, and I miss him so much. But a Kmart advertising circular. It flopped open just as I was putting it into the trash, and something fluttered out. A note printed in block letters. "Do you want out?" it read. "If yes, send message. Don't stand so close to me," is best police song. My heart was beating hard and fast, the way it did on the day I came into my house and saw the Rembrandt print over the sofa where the velvet clowns had been. Below the message, someone had drawn a Fowder. It was harmless, just sitting there all by itself, but looking at it still made all the spit in my mouth dry up. It was a real message. The Fowder proved it, but who had it come from? And how did the sender know about me? I went into the study, walking slowly with my head down, thinking. A message tucked into an advertising circular. Hand-printed and tucked into an advertising circular. That meant someone close. Someone in town. I turned on my computer and modem. I called the Columbia City Public Library, where you can surf cheap and in relative anonymity. Anything I sent would go through TransCorp in Chicago, but that wasn't going to matter. They weren't going to suspect a thing, not if I was careful. And of course, if there was anybody there. There was. My computer connected with the library's computer and a menu flashed on my screen. Just for a moment, something else flashed on my screen as well. A SMIM. In the lower right-hand corner, just a flicker. I sent the message about the best police song and added a little touch of my own down in the dead folks' nook. A sankophyte. I could write more. Things have started to happen, and I believe that soon they'll be happening fast. But I don't think it would be safe. Up to now, I've just talked about myself. If I went any further, I'd have to talk about other people. But there are 2 more things I want to say. First, that I'm sorry for what I've done. For what I did to Skipper, even. I'd take it back if I could. I didn't know what I was doing. I know that's a piss-poor excuse, but it's the only one I have. Second, I've got it in mind to write 1 more special letter. The most special of all. I have Mr. Sharpton's email address. And I have something even better. A memory of how he stroked his lucky tie as we sat in his big, expensive Mercedes. The loving way he ran his palm over those silk swords. So you see, I know just enough about him. I know just what to add to his letter, how to make it eventual. I can close my eyes and see 1 word floating there in the darkness behind my lids. Floating there like black fire. Deadly as an arrow fired into the brain. And it's the only word that matters. Excalibur.